Judges Cochran, Larson joining me, Judge Sleater, in the second of three. This matter is A240324, State of Minnesota versus Dewan Jackson, who is the appellant. And as counsel aware, each side will have, party will have 15 minutes to make your comments and 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. We are recording the proceeding, and so we do ask that you identify yourself and who you are representing when you begin your comments. And no other recording is allowed except for that in the judicial branch, but the copy of our recording will be on the judicial branch's website within 24 hours if all goes well. With that, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may approach, identify yourself, and begin.
Good morning, Your Honor. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Nate Converse of Fredrickson & Byron. I represent appellant Dewan Jackson. Mr. Jackson's right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures was violated when officers surveilling the house at 6300 Aldridge ordered that he be stopped for reasons wholly related to his mere presence in the vicinity of their investigation. The district court below erred in denying Mr. Jackson's motion to suppress, crediting officers' general and unparticularized concerns about burglary and evidence spoliation, even though no officer observed Mr. Jackson enter the house, carry any objects away from the premises, or exhibit any otherwise furtive or evasive movements. That decision was wrong, and this court should reverse. Now, the district court didn't reach the state's alternative traffic violation argument, and neither should this court. The argument advanced now in its current form for the first time on appeal was not sufficiently developed below, either factually or legally, and in fact, it's contradicted by the only testimony in the record in which the arresting officer stated he did not observe a traffic violation.
Mr. Converse, can I ask you, in your briefing, I believe you concede that the officers, because they're waiting for the search warrant to search the house, would have a legitimate or an objectively reasonable basis to be concerned about evidence being taken away from the house. And so I take from that that, for instance, you would agree it would have been appropriate the moment your client arrived for an officer who was surveilling the house to walk up and ask what he's doing there, and then basically say you can't be here or you can't go into the house at least, something along those lines, correct?
I want to clarify that a little bit, Your Honor. We don't concede that officers had a reasonable or objective basis to suspect there might have been evidence being removed from the house the facts.
Yeah, and I'm kind of back. Maybe I misread your brief. That, I think, is true, at least from what we see from the record, because he's not seen carrying anything, although apparently going back and forth multiple times, I guess, is what it sounds like. But wouldn't it be true that an officer who's awaiting a search warrant, their very purpose is to protect, we'll call it the crime scene, which in this case, the potential crime scene, meaning finding personal property in the house. So they wouldn't want anybody to go in the house. So wouldn't the officer be, would have been proper to have stopped your client, for instance, the first time he started walking to the house from going in the house, or at least start to inquire, why are you here? What are you doing? What do you want? And maybe then he would have found out it's a battery pack, I think was what I understood. You would agree that that would be proper, lawful, perhaps doesn't invoke a Fourth Amendment because they're not suspicious of him committing a crime, but still temporarily at least questioning him.
That's correct, Your Honor. We don't believe that there were objective facts giving rise to the suspicion that Mr. Jackson was actually carrying away any evidence or anything. But if that was a concern, and officers testified in general terms that it was, when they were conducting surveillance, that in that event, they could have approached Mr. Jackson, who is, by the way, at that time unidentified, without implicating the Fourth Amendment. They could have stopped him in a voluntary encounter under the Florida v. Roya case, and they could have asked him, what's he doing? Can you stay away from the scene here? We're waiting for the return of a search warrant. And in that case, Mr. Jackson would have been free to leave, and there would have been no Fourth Amendment implication there.
Were they legally obligated to do so?
They weren't, Your Honor, but they also weren't legally obligated to go in and follow Mr. Jackson away from the scene of their investigation and then stop him under a pretext of a what the state argues now to be a traffic violation. And I want to be clear here, the reason for the stop was not a traffic violation. The reason for the stop, according to officer testimony, was because the officers simply didn't think that Mr. Jackson should be there. Judge Sleater, I know you had made a reference to this multiple back and forth. And I don't agree that the record is clear on that point. I think the record, the testimony is frankly pretty inconclusive about what the actual movements that were observed were. And that's in part due to the fact that the testimony from Officer Shipp reflects that it was Sergeant Dox, who did not testify at the evidentiary hearing, reported secondhand that he had observed an unidentified male walk up to the house. His view was obstructed, so he didn't even see whether there was any activity at or around the house. And then he walked back, the man walked back and left.
I think the testimony is back and forth. So it isn't, I think there is a reasonable basis based on, or it's logical to conclude based on the testimony that it wasn't just to the door, back to the car, and leave. I mean, the testimony is it was dark out, he saw a vehicle pull up and people get out of it, and they were moving from the car to the house out of sight of his point of view and back and forth. So it's more than just based on back and forth, just more than just to the door, or more than just out of sight to the car and gone. So, but given that, you know, I think you make a good argument that his presence in the vicinity of the house, or that the car's presence in the vicinity of the house, and is not enough to support reasonable articulable suspicion. But here we have more than just being in the vicinity of the investigation or the vicinity of the house. We have the vehicle pulling up around 11 at night. It's a house where they have reason to believe that there are stolen items. The police officers do. The officer sees the people go back and forth. And the homeowner told the officer that there shouldn't be anyone at the house at 11 at night, coming there at 11 at night. So given that, you know, given, and our standard requires us to look at the totality of the circumstances, not just piecemeal evidence. So given the totality of the circumstances, what is your best argument that there wasn't reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity?
Well, Your Honor, I think the best argument that we have is that the position that's advanced by my friend on the other side is exactly the proposition that the Minnesota Supreme Court rejected in its Deedy decision. And you can read the dissenting opinion in that case in which the dissenting opinion argues that there was unusual conduct that might have been illegal even under the totality of the circumstances. And the Deedy dissent went so far as to claim that that should have supported probable cause. That proposition was rejected even under a reasonable suspicion standard, and I think the same facts here play out. We can look to a number of Minnesota and U.S. Supreme Court decisions on each of the facts Your Honor identified, such as the Brown or Ybarra decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court. Yes,
but addressing the totality of the facts themselves, I mean, I'm familiar with Deedy, but on the facts of this case, what is your best argument that it's not, there wasn't reasonable articulable suspicion, it was just a mere hunch? Because your brief does a nice job of sort of compartmentalizing the facts and arguing that, well, his presence at the location wasn't enough, and, you know, lawful activity doesn't, you know, make it give rise to a reasonable, or his activity was otherwise lawful. So, you know, your brief is very well done, but I didn't see that sort of comprehensive analysis of the facts as a whole, and that's what we need to look at.
Right, Your Honor, I understand. And even under the totality of the circumstances, the entire context of the conduct that was actually observed by officers is perfectly consistent with innocent behavior. And while the state's correct that innocent behavior can be analyzed under the totality of the circumstances, as to whether or not there was reasonable suspicion. Here, the officers didn't testify in any objective or particularized manner that ties their observations into criminal activity. The totality of the circumstances reflects that Mr. Jackson was, who was then unidentified, was observed walking up to the house. He walked back, and respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree that the testimony is conclusive as to how many times there was a back and forth.
Here's my question. What evidence is there in the record to support the idea that your client entered the home?
There is no evidence in the record, Your Honor.
And would you agree, I mean, it seems to me that outside of the traffic violation, that the concerns that the officers are expressing would have required an entrance to the home.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. In order to prove either an offense like burglary or obstruction of justice by the removal of evidence, there would have had to be an entrance into the home. There would have had to be an observation, an articulable observation of some of the evidence that was subject to the burglary investigation being removed from the house. And simply observing Mr. Jackson walking away from the house without any of those particularized objective facts is exactly what, under the totality of the circumstances, prevents this from giving rise to a reasonable suspicion.
And do we have any evidence with regard to how long he stood at the house or was up at the house? I mean, right, is there, can we infer from the testimony that he was standing at the house for some period of time that would have allowed an officer to infer that he might have entered it? Or is really all we have is that a back and forth occurred without really any evidence with regard to timing?
The testimony reflects that there was a back and forth. We don't know how many times, whether it was one or two or 10, and that Mr. Jackson was at the presence of 6300 Aldrich for, quote, a couple minutes. Looking at the totality of the circumstances, that is perfectly consistent with someone walking up to the house after getting off of a late shift of work, stopping by their friend's house, knocking on the door, receiving no response, and leaving. And because of that, we don't believe that the totality of the circumstances give rise to a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity.
Can you help? The other part that's a little vague to me, there's a lot of vagueness in this record, it seems, because the point you make is good. Back and forth, implying more than once, but only a couple minutes. What is the geographical, I assume this was an entrance from a street-facing house with a attached garage, and that he drove up onto the driveway and then walked to the house, whether back and forth. Is that a fair description? And then there was a deputy in the back and in the trees or the woods, and then the one who actually stopped him later was unrelated to the surveillance, but happened to be patrolling in the area.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And I think the biggest problem with the state's case here is that there is so much vagueness in the record. It's the state's burden at an evidentiary hearing to put on evidence that supports reasonable suspicion, and we don't think they did so. The record reflects that Sergeant Dox was sitting somewhere in an undisclosed location down the street, but that his view was obstructed in the entrance to the house by a row of trees. And that's all we really know. We don't know.
He's the one that saw?
He is the one who reported to Officer Shipp, who did testify at the evidentiary hearing and who was running the investigation. There's later testimony from Officer Ballinger, who states that he didn't remember making any report. He kind of waffles a little bit in his testimony, but says he might have been there. We're not really sure. He's the one who testifies that there was this back and forth, and frankly, I'm a little confused about his testimony on that fact. It was unprompted by any questioning. And in fact, if you look at the dash cam video from his squad car, it begins with him in an alleyway in a darked out squad car, at least a block away, and you can't even see the house. So I'm not sure how he could testify to that observation, but in any event, it's not even clear where Mr. Jackson's car was parked at the time, whether he was down the street or in a driveway. But in any event, the testimony reflects that he was there for no more than a couple minutes.
And is it, I think, undisputed factually that no one saw him carrying anything?
That's correct, Your Honor. The state does, and we concede that there are several items that were discussed in the evidentiary hearing that were named in the search warrant application that could have been concealed. But the main items that the officer testified to were things like some sort of woolly mammoth ottoman. There were computers. But even if all we had here were things like, you know, a wallet or cash or keys or something else that was subject to the burglary investigation, I don't think the testimony in the record below reflects a reasonable suspicion that those kind of items would have been were in the process of being removed.
Follow up Judge Larson's question, though, there's no evidence that he actually entered the house.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. There's no evidence he entered the house. There's no evidence he carried anything away from the house. And unlike some of the...
Is it your view that there would have to be evidence that he entered the house for there to be a reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity?
I think there would have to be, Your Honor, unless the state put on evidence saying that some of the items under suspicion were kept out on the porch or they were outside in the yard or something. That's not in the record. And again, to your point, Judge Slater, that's part of the problem with the state's case. This, just like State v. Ingram, the initial interaction that was viewed to be suspicious didn't give rise by itself.
That's because of the reasons that the police officer stated for what their suspicion was, right? I mean, the issue with needing to enter the house is because the reasons the officers gave for why they had suspicion was they were worried that they were burglary or concerned that they were taking evidence, and that's why the entrance of the home would be relevant. I just want to... It's because of the bases that the officers gave at the hearing that entrance to the home was relevant.
I agree, Your Honor. I see my time has expired, Your Honor. May I briefly conclude?
You may.
Judge Larson, I completely agree. The reasons that were stated by the officers were burglary and evidence spoliation, removing evidence of that was subject to their investigation. I think you'd have to give rise to a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity under those two offenses. You would have to have testimony and evidence, officer testimony of objective, particularized facts showing that there was an entrance into the home under investigation, that some of those items could have been or were removed, and there's none of that in the record. All we have here is speculation, in fact, less than a hunch that was occurring, and because of that, this court should reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for a respondent, you may approach, and when ready, identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Nate Summers, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, representing the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. This court should affirm Mr. Jackson's conviction because the police had reasonable suspicion to support their brief investigatory stop of Mr. Jackson. At the outset, I'd like to note how important it is just to focus on the narrow issue before the court today, and that is whether there is reasonable suspicion. So we're not talking about proof beyond a reasonable doubt, not even preponderance of evidence, reasonable suspicion, the lowest standard in criminal field.
But of a crime. So what's your short answer of the crime that the officers had a reasonable suspicion that he committed?
I would say interfering with an investigation, potentially burglary, potentially theft.
But, okay, break it down. Would you agree that the record indicates, as vague as the record is, that there's no evidence that any of the stolen items that the residents of that house were outside of the house?
So I would agree that there's no evidence that there was anything stored outside the house.
What
there's also no evidence it was all stored inside the house.
And would you agree the record does not show that no one could testify and there's no report that he actually entered the house?
Well, I think that's one of the issues, and that's one of the reasons why they stopped him, was because they lost sight of him going back and forth to the house a couple times. Doesn't have to go through the front door to get into the house. There could be an open window. There could be items in the backyard.
I think the testimony from the officer also reflects that the question was, how long were the individuals that arrived in that car present on the scene there? And the answer was, I'm not exactly sure. It was a couple of minutes. I think it was a couple of minutes that they were there. So a couple of minutes is not very long. And we have no testimony that there was, that an officer viewed the people bringing anything back to the car, and the officer also lost sight of them, didn't see them directly in front of the house, correct?
That's correct.
So So given that, how is that enough for reasonable articulable suspicion of burglary or evidence, exfoliation, where he was only in the vicinity of the house for a couple minutes and there wasn't, and an officer didn't see him bring anything back to the car?
Well, a couple points there. At the beginning, it's a lower standard, right? We're not talking about probable cause. We don't have a search warrant to stop Mr. Jackson. This is just to investigate further based on the suspicion that we saw. In the context of a house visit, especially at 11 p.m., especially for an uninvited guest, uninvited and unexpected guest, a couple minutes is a long time to walk up to a door, maybe ring the doorbell, no one answers, and leave. That also wouldn't be a back and forth. That would be a quick one up, ring the doorbell, leave.
So you think a couple minutes doesn't give you time to go back and forth, it just gives you time to go to the door and back, not back and forth.
I think a couple minutes in this context means enough time to go up to the house. It's also important that we lost sight of Mr. Jackson or whoever went up to the car, or up to the house related to the vehicle. If this was...
I'm sorry, you'd think the testimony then is that the back and forth means just going to the door once and back to the car, not back and forth more than one, not twice or more?
Yeah, the latter. I think back and forth, especially in the context of a couple minutes, means there, back.
And do you think the evidence is on the location and where the car was parked is sufficient to support going back and forth more than once?
I do. There's
In my mind, back and forth means more than once to the door, but anyway, you think, explain to us how the evidence is sufficient to support going to the door more than once, going back and forth.
I think in the context of the testimony, that the car pulls up to the north side of the residence, the person walks down to the back and forth a couple times, and then also with the couple of minutes, I think that in the general context there, it shows that there's more than enough time for something nefarious to happen.
But doesn't that potentially cut against the argument that he actually entered the home, the fact that we're talking about a couple of minutes and a significant part of that time was spent going back and forth, right? Wouldn't it be if the defendant is taking items from the home, wouldn't it be a better case to say we lost sight of him for 2 minutes and then he returned to the car, as opposed to he was there for 2 minutes or a couple minutes, and during that time, he's going back and forth. I mean, doesn't that mean that he's in the line of sight of the officers more of the time than in a just there and back circumstance?
I don't think so. I think maybe we're underestimating how long it takes to just snag a pair of keys that was left out on the deck.
Do we have any indication about when the officers executed this search warrant, whether the door was actually locked?
We do not have any indication whether or not it was. There's a brief
testimony. Whether they had asked the people who are in custody, whether they had locked the front door?
I don't think there's direct testimony in the evidence. The closest thing we have is page 15 of the transcript, where I think it's Officer Shipp at that point is asked if the door was locked, and he says it's possible. They did ask the resident who lived at the house if anyone else lived there. The answer to that was no. And they did ask, are you expecting any visitors? And the answer to that was no.
And they could have pretty simply followed up with, is the front door locked?
I mean, I think looking at it Monday morning quarterbacking, it obviously would be better. I mean, sitting here, better record is always better. And maybe moving forward, that's a question that you would ask. But on the record before the court, I think that that's more than sufficient to show that no one was expected at the house. It's 11 o'clock at night. This isn't like an Amazon delivery, right, where someone just walks up and drops something off and leaves. There's a back and forth over the course of a couple minutes.
Mr. Summers, you spend a significant part of your argument and your briefing, at least, regarding the obligation of the officers to secure the house. And that seems reasonable. It sounds like Appellant doesn't necessarily disagree with that either, that it was a reasonable effort on their part, since they're waiting on a search warrant, not to let people go in the house. So what I'm a little unsure about, though, the record doesn't show that there's any pre-knowledge based on a license plate or this vehicle or the identification of the driver or passenger, as I understand it. Just simply the officer down the block saw someone come up. And so what I'm unsure about is, why didn't the officer who was surveying the house just come over and, what are you doing here? As opposed to, he became the focus of a surveillance, even though there was no connection, as I understand it, to the robberies in that house.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't want to speculate on the officer's reasons, especially because there weren't, I mean, that's not in the record here.
Weren't the officers speculating? In other words, they were doing a lot of speculating on who these people were, because immediately upon hearing that there's someone there, tells the patrol officer to stop it. So clearly they were stopping it because of this house, this burglary, and they're there at 11 o'clock.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the express reason why they're sitting on the house, is they're waiting for a search warrant. They can't go into the house yet. They don't have a search warrant. That's the whole reason they're waiting. And they're there to secure the area, and so if someone walks up to the area, I think it's entirely reasonable just to go and stop and talk to that person.
But you don't disagree with Judge Sleater that we wouldn't be in this circumstance if the officer had just approached them while they were at the property and said, hey, what are you doing here at 11 o'clock at night, as opposed to waiting for the defendant to get in his vehicle and then making it so that there's a potential search of the vehicle. I mean, like, you can see how there's some tension here with the decision not to just go talk to him if the purpose was to secure the scene and to make sure nobody was tampering with the scene.
Well, I think to push back just a little bit, this happened relatively quickly. I know we said a couple minutes is a long time. A couple minutes also isn't a long time, especially if you're out there by yourself. You know, you've got a radio in and say, well, I'm heading out of the car, I'm going to go talk to this person. You also can't approach them while they're in the house, if they are in the house. You also lost sight of them. I think it's much safer for officers to stop them when they're in a controlled environment, where the squad cam is there.
Add to the tension, because part of your argument a couple minutes was enough to potentially have reasonable suspicion they went in and took something, versus there wasn't enough time for the officer to come from the back and ask them what they're doing.
I don't think so. I think, you know, within the context of this case, going back and forth to the house takes a couple minutes. Getting out, radioing in, letting everyone know you're going, just getting somebody else to come and watch the house, because there's only, I think, at least the record shows, one person, one officer watching the house, so you'd have to get somebody else to come and watch. I think that would take more than the couple of minutes that it would take to walk out. And you also have to catch him as he's coming to his car, because you can't talk to him when he's on the house, because again. I did want to talk briefly just about the alternative argument. You know, I'll note at the outset, the state did raise a traffic violation argument. Granted, cited the wrong statute. But the standard here is an objective officer, right? The idea that an officer has to say, I saw Mr. Jackson violate Minnesota statute 609 point, yada, yada, yada. That's just not the legal standard here. The other thing is about that is that the squad camera is all on the record.
But didn't the officer, if I recall correctly, testify that he didn't observe any traffic violation, and then follow up. I can't remember if it was on direct examination or cross examination, but basically, in his presentation of why he stopped was because they told him to stop him.
Right, and I think that's a reasonable position for the officer to take. He did say it is possible, and then there was an attempt at rehabilitation, and then I want to say that the state said, well, as long as the court's aware of traffic laws, we can just look at the dash cam, and that's exactly what we said. I think it's in the transcript at page 25, I want to say, is the officer Ballinger saying, if there was a traffic violation, it would be in my dash cam. Obviously, the dash cam is in the video.
But doesn't,
or is in the record, I should say.
The case law, DD and Cripps, require the officer to articulate the basis for suspecting the person of criminal activity. So here the officer said he didn't recall observing a traffic violation.
Yeah.
So it seems to me your argument based on Gruning is inconsistent with Deedy and Cripps.
So I don't think so, for two reasons. The first is the articulable kind of comes in and out of the reasonable articulable suspicion, depending on the case law. And it's also, it's an objective standard, right? And so if the officer went up there and said, I saw Mr. Jackson, shooting a firework off, right? Then that wouldn't be a reason. Even though he articulated it, it's not supported by the record. The record is what matters, and the law is what matters. So the fact that there was a kind of erratic driving behavior is another, I think, alternative argument for why the stop was sufficiently legal.
Is there any case law that has adopted this approach that you're advocating here today?
I think, is it Gruning?
Well, Gruning, I think, is factually different. I don't think it involved reasonable articulable suspicion.
No, but it involves an alternative.
Or a traffic stop.
Right.
Involving that.
Yeah. I think it involves an alternative argument that's supported by the record and supported by the law and wouldn't require extra relief.
But would require us to...
The factual record was sufficiently developed at a hearing, and here you're asking us to rely on a video for which there have been no factual findings made.
That's correct, but the video is in the record. You know, I don't think, you know, honestly, the court has now read at least three versions of the same video. I'm confident the court will just watch the video for what happened in it. Having an additional record of the district court saying he pulled up to the stop sign, he turned left, he turned right, he put his arm out like this, then he pulled over, I don't think that helps the court's analysis as much as the actual video of the event. Unless there are any other questions, I would just respectfully ask this court to affirm Mr. Jackson's conviction. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you may now approach, and you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start off my closing remarks with where my friend on the other side left. DD and Cripps do, in fact, require that there be officer testimony on the record stating particularized and objective reasons giving rise to a suspicion of criminal activity, even if that's a traffic stop. I think it's notable that the state doesn't cite any case in its respondent's brief for the proposition that mere inclusion of a dash cam video by itself is sufficient. And in fact, I think that would run afoul of the Supreme Court's edict in DD and Cripps requiring officer testimony. And that's because we need the reasonable suspicion standard to be based on an objective standard and articulable facts. Here, the traffic stop wasn't just not an objective reason for the stop. It wasn't even a subjective reason for the stop. Judge Slater, you were absolutely correct that Officer Ballinger testified that he didn't recall observing any traffic violation. So even if we ignore the DD and Cripps case law, a de novo review of the record, even if the dash cam footage might reflect some driving behavior that gets close to a traffic violation, which we don't concede, by the way, it still would be a finding on that fact would be inconsistent with Officer Ballinger's testimony that it was a basis for the stop, and so I don't think that would be an appropriate way for this court to affirm the judgment below. Judge Cochran, you had asked me in my opening remarks what my best argument was under a totality of the circumstances approach. The best argument is looking to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Cibrone case. All of the facts and the circumstances advanced by the state on appeal in support of the district court's order were present in some form or fashion in the Cibrone case. There was an ongoing investigation into narcotics trafficking. The behavior that was under investigation occurred for multiple hours. I think it was from 4 p.m. until midnight, so late at night, which is similar to when the conduct at issue here occurred. Even if Your Honor reviews the record and considers this back-and-forth testimony, assuming it meant more than one interaction of a back-and-forth, in Cibrone, throughout the course of several hours, the investigating officer has observed the defendant in that case going up to multiple different known drug addicts in multiple different interactions in their investigation. And still, that wasn't sufficient to find reasonable suspicion of narcotics trafficking. And I think that's a really important point because even though this individual under suspicion had been consorting with known narcotics addicts and was participating in activity that could conceivably have been consistent with drug trafficking, they didn't know anything about the individual, just like they didn't know anything about Mr. Jackson when he approached 6300 Aldrich. And for that reason, it doesn't cross the line into a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity under the totality of the circumstances. The bottom line here, Your Honor, we strip away all the general and unparticularized concerns that were relayed secondhand to the testifying officers. I think we're left with two things. On the one hand, we have Mr. Jackson's mere presence at 6300 Aldrich and some very vague testimony about what the officers' concerns were. And on the other hand, we have a legal argument by the state about a traffic violation that the arresting officer testified he didn't even observe. For those reasons, we don't believe that any of the facts here give rise to a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. And for that reason, we would ask that this court reverse the district court's order, vacate Mr. Jackson's conviction, and remand for instructions to enter a judgment of acquittal. Thank you.
Thank you, both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions and your briefing as well. We will take the matter under advisement and issue a ruling within 90 days. You have a good day.